week we basically spent all of our time about why Paul switched from the word works when he is describing the impact that the flesh makes, and the word fruit, which describes the impact that the Spirit of God makes in the lives of human beings as they live in this world, the works of the flesh or the fruit of the Spirit. And the most fundamental issue that's involved in the works of the flesh has to do fundamentally with getting credit for working hard. That's why works is a big deal. Because people who are energized by the flesh are much interested in getting credit for the things they accomplish or the works they do. That's a fundamental characteristic of flesh. And in relation to that, the hard work that people do in the flesh is invariably all about trying to get three things accomplished: a greater degree of pleasure in the body, diminishing of the levels of conflict with the relationships just in their inner circle of relationships. They try to keep that to a minimum while pursuing the pleasure, and then getting credit for the things that they're accomplishing. They're looked up to and revered by their group. That's what the works of the flesh are all about. In contrast to that, it is the most fundamental reality of the Spirit of God. It's not self-promoting. And it is His ministry in our bodies and through our bodies to others. It is His goal to produce a greater degree of joy in the lives of those that He is able to touch without any regard to the cost that's involved to Himself. That's the fruit of the Spirit. This evening we're going to actually move from the works fruit theological contrast and look at the issues that are involved in this fruit of the Spirit thing, because there are nine things that are characteristics of the fruit of the Spirit. And that's where we're going to be looking this evening, Galatians chapter 5. So, I know that we've covered some of this material from different directions on different occasions, and the Bible repeats itself many times too. But I would like for us, maybe this evening, in terms of the way we process this class. I know that we record, and it's difficult for the mic to pick up what's being said, but I would like for us to think together this evening about some old themes as well as the new ones in relation to the fruit of the Spirit being, first of all, love. That's where we're going to be this evening. Don't panic. We may not be on the fruit of the Spirit for 9 weeks, but no promises, but this evening we're not going to go beyond love, but that is a fundamental big issue. So we're going to spend some time of thinking our way through the whole idea of the Spirit of God producing love in us so that we are the recipients of the benefit of that in our perception. Also, our bodies then are energized to function in loving ways. And that's the whole idea of the fruit of the Spirit being love, which produces a certain kind of attitude and action. The term that's used is the term agape, and you're all familiar with that word. And you've heard me say enough times that you have to be really careful about what you hear about agape, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. Greek was in the Greek language before the New Testament was ever written, so it's not a special New Testament word. So when people tell you things that require it to be a special New Testament word, you know immediately that's not true. Agape is not a weird Greek word. It's been around for a long, long time, and was before the New Testament was written too. Culture knew what agape meant. But obviously, if the fruit of the Spirit is being characterized fundamentally beginning with agape, then there's something about that concept that we need to get a real clear grip on. Because I said last time, close to the end of our study, that anything more important than having a way to decide what is important. You have to have a way to decide what's important. And until you do that, there's nothing more important in your whole scenario of life, because you can't do things without knowing what's important, what's valuable. That's what the Greek word agape was coined, question of value. What is important? when somebody exercised agape love toward another person or a thing, what they were doing was assigning value to that person or thing. And agape, because it is an assignment of value kind of concept, has several characteristics that are involved in that. One of them is the selective of value. And I mean by that, that assigning value to things automatically means you select a certain value for this thing, and you select a different value for that thing, and you select a different value for this thing, or we could say persons. The point is, in any given situation, there's always the potential for conflict in the assignment of values of persons and things, so that a kind of necessity, you can't love anything equally with another thing or person. There's this passage in Romans 9 where God, Jacob I have loved, to this tailspin about God hating Esau. It doesn't seem to bother him that he loved Jacob, but I mean, Jacob was, in terms of character and all that, he wasn't any better than Esau. I mean, they were both not godly men. The thing you have to keep in mind is that in the Romans 9 scenario, God had made a promise about a coming Redeemer, and there could only be one person in each generation who was the progenitor of the next generation from which Christ would be produced. So there could never be two men in the same generation, or brothers, or whatever, who could both be equally valued in terms of God's assignment of value in terms of the production of Messiah. He had to choose somebody. He had to select somebody. Same thing was true when it came down to, okay, who's going to bear my son? Mary is one of about 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4 million, I don't know how many women there were on the planet. He had to choose a woman. Now, there were some parameters already set in place. She had to be of David's lineage, because the promise had been to David that it would be his son that would be Messiah. There was that kind of limitation, but David was from the tribe of Judah, and David had multiple sons and daughters. He had multiple. There were lots of women who would have qualified as the offspring of David. He couldn't choose them all. Only one woman could bear the son. So he chose Mary. That's selection. And guard, he loved Mary more than any. That doesn't mean he was more emotionally involved with her. Doesn't mean he was more willing to do things for her than any other woman. Doesn't mean that. It just means that you assign value in light of a certain thing, and when you do that, you've made a choice. You've made a selection. It's a selective assignment of value. And in that light, it's an assignment of value to matters that arise when you're talking about the course of events with goals in mind. So, course of event. I mean, we all live in this fluid thing called life, and now all these things are going on, and we're all involved in multiple things of life 24/7. Even when we're asleep, we're still physically and what we're plugged in. Things are either happening to us, through us, in spite of us, whatever. We're in this mix. And in this mix, there's nothing more important than deciding what's important. So there has to be a goal that you're shooting for. I mean, you're sleeping for a reason, right? And when you get up, you're going to start doing things, and you don't do anything without a reason. It may not be a good reason, but you don't do anything without a reason. There's no such thing as action without a motivation driving it. So that's a reason. The thing that's crucial is for the reason to be a legitimate one. That's why it's the Spirit of God. It's His job to make sure that we're reasoned for production of a certain goal. So, that means then that we're talking about in the production of the fruit of the Spirit being, first of all, agape. What we're being told here is that it is God the Holy Spirit's job, assignment from the Father, in your body and in mind, to ferret out in your values and in mind those values that are valuable and those values that are not, and to establish value so that this is more important than that, this is more important than that, this is more important than that. Because that's how we're going to function through our life. We're going to do things based on how valuable the accomplishment is, and we're going to refrain from doing things based on how worthless the end. That's the way we live. And there isn't anything you do, from tying your shoe to eating your lunch to going to sleep at night or whatever. None of those things are art without end, without a goal, without something in mind. But every one of those goals is a sub-goal for the accomplishment of another goal. We've talked about this many times. You do this in order to accomplish this. But as soon as you accomplish this, that becomes a foundation for pursuit of another goal. In other words, in a cause-effect universe, every effect becomes a cause as soon as it has been affected. As soon as you do something to accomplish something, the accomplishment then becomes a production for the next accomplishment. There's always going to be this movement up the stairs until you get to the point where you have accomplished the last thing. And that accomplishes nothing else. It's the final goal, the ultimate objective. And that means that for every believer, the Spirit of God is going to, at some point or another, begin to bear down on our understanding of what our goal is supposed to be in life. What are we here for? What is the ultimate objective? I'm not like when I was a young pastor, just graduated out of Bible college, floundering around in my ignorance. We had a guy come to a conference that I attended. I think it's in Sioux City, Iowa, or somewhere over there. But he came up from Dallas Seminary to speak, and he said that you ought to order your life according to the goals that are valuable things, and you should eliminate everything that's not valuable. Well, nice theory. How do you do that? On any given day, how do you decide what's valuable and what's not? Who knows what's going to happen when you do this? And whenever whatever happens because you did this, who knows what's going to happen next? So that for you or me to say, well, my goal in life is this, and I'm going to order my life so that this is the final, you're assuming a way higher degree of wisdom than you have to figure that all out. So I'm not one of those that says you ought to order your life according to your priorities. I think that's the reason why Paul calls it the fruit of the Spirit. He's the only one who can effectively order our lives a day at a time and get things to work out right. In fact, we're commanded by Jesus not to worry about tomorrow, which means that we're not supposed to be trying to plan too far ahead. Why not? Well, because that's the bottom line. You don't know how to plan for an eventuality that ever happened. It's like the lady said, you know. Somebody says, lady, you're not supposed to worry about everything. Don't you know that 95% of the stuff you worry about doesn't happen? She says, see how effective it is? So, point is, it's the fruit of the Spirit. It is God, the Holy Spirit's job to make us see the importance of a thing at the right time and in the right setting so that we can operate according to the value of that thing. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have some kind of an idea of what the ultimate goal is. That has brought the debate into play about the fact that you need to understand what the chief end of man is. You need to know what God has said men exist for, because you're one of them. I mean, generic man, male and female. What if you think that the goal that God has for men is this, but it's that? As long as you're thinking this way, you'll have great difficulty yielding to the Spirit of God on things that would produce this. But it won't produce this, and you can see it won't. So you fight with him over that, because that's not the way you're supposed to be going. So this is where I want us to be thinking about the theological end of man, because every goal, every action you take has a goal in mind, and every goal is a sub-goal for another accomplishment of another goal until you finally get to the final one. So you need to have an idea of where you're headed. That's the chief end of man. Where are we headed? What's God got it for? And of course, most of us are aware that the phrase, the chief end of man, is a Calvinist, comes out of a popularization of a theological construct called the Westminster Confession, or Catechism, or whatever. The chief end of man is what? Right. But that's wrong. That's what the Catechism says, the truth. Can't be the truth. And you say, well, how can it not be the truth? That's what I'm asking you. How come that's not truth? When the Westminster Catechism says the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever, how come that's not true? Right. So it can't be the chief end if there's two chief ends, okay? That's one reason. Why else?
There's a whole lot of men.
That's the problem. That's the major problem, besides the numerical. You cannot make the chief end of man the enjoyment of God forever if the Bible teaches that the majority of men will not enjoy God forever. That's the doctrine Jesus taught when He said, strive to go in through the narrow. Because the way to destruction is a broad way, and the gate broad way is very big, and many that gate into destruction, and the narrow gate to life is difficult to discover, and few find it. Well, when Jesus said that, He basically said the majority of humanity will not enjoy God forever. He said that. He didn't say it in those words, but He said that. You cannot be accused of enjoying God forever if you're perishing, if your whole experience is eternal Gehenna forever and ever and ever. It can't be. So, you have to just minister confession, you believe in Jesus' words. It can't be. A goal that's not going to be experienced by men, the vast majority of men, cannot be the goal that God has set up for men. Is that clear? There is a reason for the theological debate. What is the chief end of man as far as God's concerned? But the answer to the question that is most popular now in this generation is an erroneous answer. It's not to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. And we've eliminated the enjoy Him forever thing based on the fact that the vast majority of men will not enjoy Him forever, so that can't be the chief end of man. Didn't God know when He created humanity that there would be a bunch of human beings who wouldn't enjoy Him forever? Didn't He know that? Well, sure He did. Well, then, could that be His chief end for men? Absolutely not. It'd be foolish for God for men that it's not going to be achieved by men. It's not going to happen for them. That part of it's not right. About the chief end of man is to glorify God. Why isn't that true? Doesn't the Bible say, do and do, whether you eat or drink or do all to the glory of God? Doesn't it say that? Sure it does. Does it say that's the ultimate objective? No, it doesn't. It says we're supposed to do that. It also says you're not supposed to commit adultery, and you're supposed to tell the truth, and you're supposed to love your spouse. We're given all kinds of commands. How do we decide what the chief value is, the highest value? This is what agape is about. It's about deciding what's most important. Well, is glorifying God the most important thing? Why is it not? It's not. I'm telling you that. Why is it not? I want you to tell me. Think about that. Why? What's wrong with saying the chief end of man is to glorify God? What? Yeah, and the fact is, the statement to glorify God does imply another purpose. If glorifying God is a means to an end, that's the chief end, we're talking about a means to another end. See, Paul said that you, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all the glory of God. Didn't he say that to Corinthians? Isn't that where that's found? I think it was. But one of the things, whether it was or it wasn't, he did say to Corinthians, he said, it appalls me, and these are my words, but he said, there are people who don't know God to your shame. You guys have been behaving. People can't get to know God. It's a shame. that you're behaving in such a way that you're actually frustrating the knowledge of God in other people's lives. So he said you're supposed to glorify God, and whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, that way people will get to know God, because to glorify God means his attributes and character. That's what glorifying God means. The word to glorify means to make manifest or to make obvious, to demonstrate clearly. So, in a Corinthian setting where the people are acting in a carnal way, Paul castigates them for not glorifying God because it's got an effect on other people. Now, what then would be the purpose of glorifying God? Huh? To have this positive impact on other people so that other people can get to know what God is like. Now, I will change a little bit of what Heather said about getting people to come to him, because there are some people, when you glorify God, they're going to hate him even more than they do, simply because they don't like him in the first place, and then when they see what he's really like, they really don't like him. So it won't be just to bring them, but it will at least make his character clear to their face. Then have another ramification. So even glorifying God so that people can understand what God's like, even understanding what God's like is not the end. It's means to another end. What's the other end? What happens when you get to know what God's really like? What? Well, yeah, you may.
I said you might follow.
You might. That'd be one side of the choice. The other one I just mentioned, you might decide even more vehemently that you don't want to follow him. Because Jesus did that, John chapter 6. He told his disciples some things about God they didn't want to hear. They said, no, not going that way. I'm not going to follow that. And then they turned around and walked away. Well, they walked away from the glory of God. They walked away from Jesus making God the Father's character made more clear. They saw it. They didn't like it. They walked away. Jesus turned to his disciples and said, are you leaving too? And Peter said, well, where are we going? Why did he say that? What else did he say there? To whom shall we go? You have the words of what? Life. Now this is eternal life. Aha! Now we're getting close to the final result. What's going to happen if you get to know God and you like what you know? Huh? Yeah, you're going to actually begin to interact with him, and his life will flow to you, and you'll possess the life. Jesus said, this is life eternal, that they might know thee. Well, knowing thee means that he has been glorified in their midst so that they can get to know him. So the chief end of man is not to glorify God. That's just one of the goals that men should have. If the goal is to glorify God, then the obvious implication is, well, you want somebody to see that glorification so that they can respond to God one way or another. And the Bible even says that God is instructing the angels based on what the church is doing. So the church is glorifying God and the angels are learning about him. And some of those angels that are learning this stuff about him hate him even more than they do now when they learn it. And others are really puzzled about some of the stuff they're seeing. They want to get into this and dig into it and find out more about it, because they've never even thought about God being like that. And they've been in his presence for thousands of years. But they never thought about that, because it never had an occasion to see God in that light until God did something in the church and he was glorified by that. And they said, oh, I never thought about that. And as they begin to think about it and as they begin to respond to it, they get a greater experience of his life. What does that produce? What happens when a person gets a greater experience of life? Are we getting close to the chief end of man here?
Well, I'm struggling over the fact that that's the minority.
Yeah, that's going to happen. People are going to get to know God. One way or another, they're going to either like it or not like it. Okay? So the knowledge of God is getting right up there close to the top of what's going to happen, what's going to be produced. let's take the negative side first, and I'm way off my notes now, but I don't care, because I wanted y'all to interact with me. Let's suppose that a person gets to know something that's true about God and he really doesn't like it, and he decides, I am not going there. I'm not going to listen to that. What happens to him? His life, actually, his experience begins to deteriorate even worse than it was. Because every time you rebel against the truth, the quality of your experience degenerates. The more you reject, the more degeneration there is. The degeneration allowed to be pursued for physical life will put you in a certain place in hell. Because that's the end result of rebellion against the truth and rejecting it. In that case, you're fortunate if you die young, because you dug your hole too deep. There are degrees to loss. What possible good could that have? Why would God even set that up that way? So that the reaction that people have to the glory that is Him would create a greater disaster for the person who rebels against it. Why would God set that up? Yes, it does. It actually will. Absolutely will. Because Paul said in Romans chapter 9, what if God, willing to make his wrath and power known, endured with much long suffering vessels of wrath fitted for destruction? In other words, what he's arguing is, look, God wants to make himself known to a certain category of personality, a category of personality that says, I like what I'm hearing. I like what I'm seeing. I like what I'm discovering. And it causes life to be the result for that category of individual, person, this angelic or human. Any person that learns something true about God and likes it will get that much more of an experience of life out of it. Jesus said men will live every word, so that every word has a little thing of life attached to it. And if you buy the word, you get the life. If you like the word, you get the life. You like a lot of words, you get a lot of life. So life is the issue. You're supposed to be able to enter into a greater capacity for living by seeing God as He is, discovering the truth about Him, having Him being glorified in your mind and heart in a way that makes you say, wow, that's so neat. And you enter into this life thing. A part of that, for the person who likes it, is learning more and more and more about the truth, about God according to the truth. And part of that is what we would call the negative characteristics. Wrath, judgment, those things. If you don't know those things about God, then your experience of His life is truncated by that lack of. So the less you know about God, the less life you experience. So if He doesn't make His wrath known, if He doesn't make His power known, your experience of eternal life is going to be limited by those decisions on His part not to make that known. So what He's decided to do is not put those kind of barriers in the play. He's actually saying this. He gets to know something true about me and rejects it and perishes because of their rejection. Those who understood it and liked will see in the rejection something even more profound, and they will get more life while they get. In other words, those that perish serve those who experience life. They actually enhance the experience of life for those who are seeing this destructive thing as an outworking of a part of the character of God. So what is the chief end of man at? Why does God let angels and humans perish? What's the goal there? What would Romans 9 say? He wants to make himself known in some way. Why? So people that are not put off by it will have greater experience of life. It's the final ultimate thing. I think that for myself, I've not been able to progress further than this. I can't find a result for that's higher than the joy of life. you have the joy of life, what would that produce beyond itself? In other words, if that's not the chief end, if that's not the ultimate end, what is?
Right. So that can't, I mean, if your first argument says that can't be because you didn't, then
what?
Your chief joy is life, but it's not.
Well, there are very few that
are very few that will go down that path. So I mean, that back up your chief and almost the same knowing God.
No, because knowing God produces something. That can't be the chief end. The chief end is what it produces.
It can produce, I mean, it will produce one of two things.
Right.
But it won't produce for all.
No. And we're not talking about what it produces for all. We're talking to all men. What is God doing in all lives aside? The joy of life is God's goal for some. It's not his goal for everybody because he himself said it's not going to happen for everybody. So the joy of life isn't the chief end of all men. But the joy of life is the chief end. In light of what God does with those who reject it, because they become instruments in his hands, not for their joy, but of those opposite them in terms of attitude. So then what are they? They're not going to experience joy, so that's not God's chief end for them. What is his
chief?
For whose understanding? Huh? The few who believe it. This is the point. The chief end of man has to be defined in terms of how God is using all men to a given end. He uses all men to accomplish joy for some men. You can't escape that. If you're one of the some who's going to experience the joy in your life will actually produce joy in the lives of others. So joy is there, and you can't escape being used as an instrument of God for the joy of somebody. Because if you embrace it, you'll be the cause of joy for somebody, so many somebodies. And if you reject it, he'll still use you as a joy for somebody. It just won't be you. In other words, your own rebellion will become a way for them to learn better about God, and their life improved by it, even though yours won't be. Does that make sense so far?
I think the only issue you run into is that with that clarification for the chief end, then the enjoy them forever on the catechism part could be applied the same way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, except that I would say it like this. The chief end of man is to be a useful instrument in God's hands for the joy of end of all men. God is going to use all men for the accomplishment of joy for some men. If the chief end is not joy for every man, but it is joy for some men, then you have a chief end. There are some who are going to have joy, angels and humans. And the chief end for God's purpose for man's existence is to enhance that joy for those who are going to inherit it. There isn't any other rationale for all of the negative stuff. Even the smoke of the torment of those in Gehenna that ascends up before the throne of God forever and ever. The book of Revelation says the smoke of hell ascends up to the throne of God to say, well, why in the world would you want this eternal reminder of the wrath of God on angels and humans who rebelled against the truth and refused to embrace it? Why would you want this constant reminder? Well, there are all kinds of benefits to being reminded of things when you're not omniscient. So all through eternity, there are going to be all kinds of things that are just constant reminders of the character of the God who saved us. All kinds of them. The smoke going up is just one of them. But that one does remind us of the wrath of God, which is one of the attributes of God that's necessary for us to understand in order to relate to Him properly so that we can have the joy of life that comes from relating to Him properly. If our God is not a God of wrath, then our experience of life is cut short by that absence. That's why God said He was going to make His wrath known. Joy for some is His objective. And He's going to use all to accomplish that goal for some.
It's the same. It's the reverse for the angels. The angels saw His wrath without grace and forgiveness. Whereas He is man to show the angels
the grace and the forgiveness.
It's a flip-flop.
Sure. Yeah.
It's that same.
Exactly. So when we start talking about why you and I exist, we exist to be the instruments of God for the joy of somebody else. That's agape. It's not your joy that's involved here. Even if you want the joy of life, even if you're very positive about the things you're learning about God and it fills you with joy, that is not your objective. As long as your objective is still wrapped around you, you're still being selfish. It's the joy of life for somebody else. And God is going to force that, those who resist being used by God for somebody else's sake. And that's the problem with the selfish world. The selfish world says, I don't want to be used as an instrument for somebody else's benefit. I want them to be used as an instrument for my benefit. That's the selfishness of man. God says, that's not the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is other folks. It's not about you. It's about somebody else. And you're supposed to be a willing instrument for the sake of that somebody else. And I'm going to use you that way, whether you like it or not. If you don't like it, you'll become a negative illustration, but it'll still be positive in the light of those who do like it. And if you do like it, it won't be about you. It'll be about somebody else that's benefiting because God is using you to help them increase in joy. So are we at a position where we can say what agape is? Agape is coming to grips with the fact that God has ordered His entire creation to be a mechanism for the production of joy for those who trust His truth, who trust Him, who believe Him. He's going to produce joy for those who believe Him. He's going to use everything in His creation to do that. That's why He can say in Romans 8:28 that everything is going to work together for good. Because He's going to make it happen. And the rebels, bless their hearts, it ain't going to do them any good at all to rebel. It's a futile, because God's going to use them anyway, the way He wants to. And they can grind their teeth, and they can scream and shout and carry on all they want. It ain't going to make any difference. God's going to use them to produce joy for others. So, it's a whole lot better just to give the fight and say, okay, I want to be an instrument of joy for somebody else. Then you're on the right target. That's where you begin to understand the fruit of the Spirit is. Because the agape of the Spirit is all about being willing to be what God has intended for every human to be, and that is an instrument for the production of joy for somebody else. The chief end of man is to be an instrument of God for the production of joy for somebody else. It's not about enjoying God yourself forever. It's about somebody else enjoying God forever. Because you are an instrument in God's hand to make that happen. That's the reason why when we talk about agape in a biblical orientation, we get really into this thing about this kind of love is so strange because it says it's not about me. This kind of love is the love of God because He's the first one who said it's not about me. It's about you. And therefore, when we can get to the point where we understand that the first thing that's going to characterize the fruit of the Spirit of God in our lives is a switching from the focus on ourselves to someone else. And when we recognize that all of the things that we're doing in our lives are going to be used for the joy of someone else, even the bad things, because God's going to force it to happen. We're going to be instruments of joy for someone else, regardless whether cooperate or rebel. He's going to do it. Romans 8:28 is just the positive side of that. You get to be a willing instrument for somebody else's joy. God's going to work everything together for that good. So, the real issue here is that when Paul starts out talking about the fruit of the Spirit is agape, what he's telling us is the most difficult issue in all of creation is going to be handled for you by the Spirit of God in you. You may not know what God's intention is in this particular or that particular on this day or that day, but the Spirit of God who dwells in you does. So, if we're willing to accept that as truth, we'll get to enter into the joy of being a useful instrument in God's hands. If we rebel against it or reject it or say, well, that's a delusion or whatever, then we still are going to be used as an instrument of joy for somebody else, but it'll be against our voluntary involvement. But our involvement doesn't make any difference in terms of whether he's going to get done what he wants done. You can cooperate with him and enjoy it, or you can fight him and not enjoy it, but nonetheless, he's God, you're not, and he's going to have his way, and you're not, unless your way is his way. So, the whole issue is that in respect to God and God, agape is a fixation on the production of joy for someone else. That's the first characteristic of the fruit of the Spirit. In respect to the necessity for the Spirit of God to be directly involved in this, the whole idea is the agape of God is so the means to the end, are so many and so varied and so complex that none of us can decide on any given day whether this is loving and that's not, unless the Bible has told us. I mean, we can always say anything the Bible has forbidden is not agape from the Spirit of God, but there are so many things that are not agape, and we don't know. But He does. That's the whole issue. He does. And it's His commitment to those who trust Him to fulfill His promise to them. That's living by faith, where He makes promises and you believe them. The interesting thing about that is the more experience we get in this world, the better able we are to see the wisdom in certain things. And then we can make choices that enhance that, move in that direction. The human mind tends to operate in a logical way. That's a way of thinking. But fallen men, their logic is distorted by their own self-interest. So they're not logical anymore. That's why God, it says, gave them up to reprobate mind. They're not capable of logic because the logic would force them to become selfless, and they're not interested in that. I don't want to be used for somebody else's joy. I want them to be used for mine. Well, get alive. It's not going to happen. You're going to be used for their joy whether you like it or not. The encouragement here is the more you embrace that, the more joy you get out of being involved in the production of joy for others. It's casting your bread on the water and getting it back after many days. You benefit because God's that kind of God. He won't let you make a sacrifice that's real in final analysis. If you make a sacrifice for somebody else's sake, God sees that and He says, and I'm going to bring this benefit because I'm so tickled with what I just saw. And in a little while you think, that wasn't really a sacrifice. I gained more than they did. That's your perspective. And it makes you even more free to be loving toward other people because you see God as incapable of letting you lose in any way. We've been out of time, but you have anything else you want to say about that? Because next week we're going to move into the next issue, Lord willing. That's joy. But till then, what do you think?
Well, in my own mind, I'm still struggling for a while. And the thing that I think I'm convinced by, the way that I've convinced myself of the fact that the cut before the chief end is so that he can reveal himself. in the fact that without that revelation of himself, no one could know.
Exactly right.
So there I'm able to get to the chief end that is, I want someone to be able to know this.
Yeah.
And the only way that I can get anyone to know this is to reveal myself. And the only way that I can completely reveal myself is by having the split of good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that helps anyone else, but it helps it in my mind. But past the fact that right before the chief end, and then my other comment is on the fact that all my growing up being a Christian knew of, you hear the fact that you can't have the love of God without, but the fact that there's the fruit of the Spirit, you can't, everything anyone will ever do for love is for love of self, redirected because, you're going to do this for someone else because of what it does for you, my ego or my position, or it guides in the fact that it looks like love of putting someone else above, but it's always the end goal of all of that, the chief end of all human love is love of self.
Right.
And so it's impossible for it to be a work. The love as a human work is not love.
It's not the agape of God.
It's impossible to have the love that he's talking about.
Except by him.
As a woman.
Right.
It has to be of his spirit.
Exactly.
It is.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. And I think that this whole concept of love as an establishment of final value actually is the answer to the problem of evil that everybody struggles with. Because the answer there is, God had, in order to give life to anybody, he had to have somebodies that were going to do the wrong things. And that would allow him then to demonstrate his wrath and power and all that. And that would allow those who are willing to trust him to experience a greater degree of life. The whole issue is going to come back. Paul's writing Galatians to emphasize the issue of faith. By faith, you participate. By unbelief, you don't. But you're still involved in the chief end because God's still using you, whether you like it or not. But by faith, you can like it. Participate in it.
God's wonderful mercy, divine grace, and life, and the vine, the creature?
Yeah. The vine.
Yeah,
it depends. It depends. If it's a grapevine, if it's a muscadine vine, the vine thing is still the basic trunk of the plant, whether it's a tree trunk or a vine trunk or... Yeah, the...
More the
vines y'all swung on are more like branches off the main vine. Okay? But the main trunk, that's what Jesus says, I'm the vine, I'm this main trunk thing. And everything that comes out of this is a branch that will... Okay. Right.
Everybody in Israel knew what a vine was, what a grapevine was.
Yeah, but some of them were still struggling theologically with the whole idea of fruit because they were so wrapped up in works, theology. Yeah, it's a major human problem because we have this natural inclination to run to the works mindset. It's just as automatic as breathing to run through. But that's the consequence of the fall, Genesis 3. If we hadn't had that sinful thing in put in place, our natural inclination would be to run the fruit. We would automatically see ourselves as instruments of God for somebody else's sake. That's what being a branch is. You just bear this fruit. Because his life flows through you to somebody else. That's what branches do. They just hang there and let the fruit feed somebody. But it's about believing him. That's how he hangs.